Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello, and welcome to Waiting for the Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, where we are waiting for the issue to come out. And we talk about the Doom Patrol in general, and we talk about old Doom Patrol. And when we started the show, there was no Doom Patrol comic, but now there is. So, and that's how we got here today.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at AvantGarve. You can reach us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com or on our Waiting for Doom Facebook page. You can also check out mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com for related posts to all our episodes from friend of the show, Doug Zavisha. And all our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com.
And I'm Paul. You can find me on Twitter at reading_Hicks. And we also have a Sentient Show Twitter account, which is Wilfred at WFDPod. And we are sponsored by Comicosity, the comic book website.
Yes, Comicosity.com. I love that site. This week, something that stood out to me is Matt Santori continues his interview with Steve Orlando about the upcoming Justice League of America books that are coming out as part of Rebirth, and talking about the Ray and Killer Frost. And I'm kind of keen to see what Steve does with those.
So, I'm keeping my eye on that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. He does some good stuff, old Mr. Orlando. So, well, he's not really old, but yeah. Anyway, how was your week in comics and life and such, Paul?
Yeah, very good, thank you. I've been catching up on my reading. I picked up The Vision, the second trade that arrived in the mail for me, and I started to read it and stopped and thought, I need to reread the first Vision trade again. Because I'm a little bit rusty on the details. Right. But, yes.
Any animal violence or violence towards animals in the second volume so far?
I can't say. Well, not where I got up to.
Right, okay.
Yeah. All right. It's one of the touch points with you, is it?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I'm sure I will revisit it one day because it was an interesting story and setup, but, killing off the dog and putting its brain in an android robot dog. Yeah. Anyway, what else have you been up to?
Just catching up with some movies. I watched Gods of Egypt, which is... it made the list of a lot of the worst films of 2016.
Okay.
And I didn't mind it. It was not appalling. There's no Jupiter Rising, if you know what I mean.
Oh, my God. Oh, that good, huh?
It was watchable, as long as you weren't looking for any actors from Egypt.
Right. Okay.
It's like white dudes of Egypt. Uh-huh. Yeah. But, why can't Brian Brown be king of all the gods? Why not?
God.
Yeah, what about you, Mike?
I actually caught up on some more of my to-read pile. A lot of Marvel stuff. Amazing Spider-Man, Miss Marvel, Captain Marvel, sort of in... Well, the two Marvel books are kind of in the whole Civil War II storyline at the moment. So, a bit of conflict going on there. A bit of Avengers. Decent chunk. Still a crap ton of stuff in my pile to read. I will get there eventually. What else? I've been rewatching Batman the Animated Series, and I finished off the first series of that. And my God, that's a great cartoon. It's like 25 years old or something, but... this year, I think it's the 25th anniversary, but some of the stories and the art in it, just a lot of fun. And I started watching the series of Unfortunate Events show on Netflix, based on the books by Lemony Snicket, with Neil Patrick Harris as Count Olaf. And it was quite enjoyable. I thought they did a really good job with it so far. So, yeah, I would highly recommend that if you like a bit of dark humor and a bit of pantomime where you're kind of yelling at the screen behind you, not literally, but that sort of vibe. And children in peril, but using their wits to escape said peril. And it's a lot of fun. I did read the books, or I think I didn't finish the book series, but I read the majority of it when they came out years and years ago. So it's quite an enjoyable thing to chill out and watch if you're into your Netflix binge watching. for you?
Yeah, it's quite a blind spot for me. I'm unfamiliar with the books and the film and the TV show and anything related to it. It's a blind spot. Anyway.
Well, if you're looking for something a little bit dark and a little bit melancholy but still quite entertaining, yeah, you'd probably enjoy it.
Yeah. It's a very specific mood I need to be in, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, yes. But still enjoyable nonetheless. Yeah.
Hmm. Shall we go down on Darrington Way?
Please. Sorry, that was a little bit over-enthusiastic.
Okay, it's one of those exciting months where exciting week where we get a new solicitation for a new issue of Doom Patrol. We don't get a new issue of Doom Patrol, but we get a preview of what the issue 7 will be.
And good enough.
Yeah. So Newsarama got the leak on this, so the solicits won't be out until tomorrow morning Australian time. So by the time you listen to this podcast, the full solicits will be out. But we know that Doom Patrol number 7 is written by Gerard Way, art by Michael Allred.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, Mike Allred on Doom Patrol. Now, that's such a natural fit, isn't he? Anyway, there's a backup story by Brandon Bird, who I don't know who Brandon Bird is, but I will be Googling that name shortly. Cover by Mike Allred and variant cover by Nick Darrington.
Ooh, okay.
Young Nick Darrington.
Still up and coming.
Yeah, lovely. And here is the solicit text. And it says, "How have you been, Niles Calder? The chief is back and he's ready to reshape the new Doom Patrol to be just like the old Doom Patrol, a prospect not everyone is happy with. But the team's former leader hasn't grown less manipulative in his old age, so nobody make any rash decisions. Pretty sure he's up to something. Mike Allred from iZombie Silver Surfer joins Young Animal for this special one-off issue. On sale 26th of April, 32 pages, full cover, color, $3.99 US, for mature readers. Do you think we can read it?"
Well, we better, otherwise we won't have a lot to talk about that week.
Yeah, and there's a lovely cover of the Doom Patrol, and there's sort of like a white landscape with all these holes, and the holes, the Doom Patrol sort of popping out upside down and backwards and all sorts of things. So
it's very cool.
Yeah, and Rita's there, but she looks like she's got a gammy leg coming out of the boot. Interesting.
Speaking of interesting, I find it interesting that solicit comes out and mentions the chief being manipulative. And
yes.
Such, in light of what we'll be discussing later on this episode.
Yeah. Interesting. And there's another little tidbit. So Robert Venditti is the writer of the Green Lantern Corps, Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps comic. And he did an interesting tweet where he said, "Just finished reading this. Next on the to-do list, plot the next arc of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps." So, and he was reading On Paradise Way, well, the second volume of the Doom Patrol Grant Morrison collections, which has, if you were writing space stuff, there's a few things you could probably use from there. Like Rhea Jones, Lodestone, she sort of evolved into this new being and went off into space.
Never to be seen or heard from again.
Yeah, and we also had the aliens, the anathematicians of, and the insect mesh. So weird aliens. So maybe that sort of stuff is going to come back somehow in the Green Lantern Corps, or it could just be unrelated and it's something he read. Don't know.
When I saw that tweet, I kind of first thought, it's unrelated. He's just finished reading it, and maybe it's given him some ideas, but he won't incorporate any of that Doom Patrol stuff. However, I would love to see him include that stuff in the Green Lantern Corps, because that would kind of be a bit out there, I think.
It would be a bit out there. It's, Green Lantern Corps seems like a pretty, straight, regular shelf book. It doesn't seem like it's, bending any brains, does it?
and it could even lead to, a crossover between DC proper and Young Animal Verse.
Maybe. Well, it looks like the Young Animal Verse is sort of crossing over with the DC universe whenever it wants, because Cave Carson as a cybernetic guy has a flashback story with Superman coming out in April.
Yes. And, I saw that cover.
And I've read Mother Panic number one, and that had Batman in it. So.
Well, true, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Anyway, is that a ticking noise I hear?
It sure is, Paul, and it can only be the Doom Clock!
Oh.
Behind you. Okay, so the Doom Clock is telling us that the last Doom Patrol book we had was issue 3 of volume 6, which came out 10 weeks ago. 10 weeks since the last Doom Patrol book, so they're making us wait, even in this day and age.
Yeah.
2017, we got a new Doom Patrol book, and we're still waiting for it. However, issue 4 is due 24th of January 2017, so only a week away. That's not so bad.
No.
We can live with that.
Yeah.
Last appearance of the Patrol United as a team was a year and 23 weeks ago in two different comics, All-Star Section 8 number 3 and Justice League United number 12. But they should be back together, united as a team, by issue 6 of the current volume. Surely. Surely they will be.
It has to be.
Has to be, yeah. And this week in Doom Patrol history, going on sale for a mere 12 cents... on January 21st, 1965, with a cover date of March 1965, was Doom Patrol 94 from Arnold Drake and Bruno Premiani. This issue featured two tales of the Patrol, the Nightmare Fighters and the Chief Stands Alone. And the first story saw the team face off against Ozra the Spirit Being, or were they really? While the second story saw the Chief and his action chair take on the villainous Claw.
Yes, I do.
That was kind of funny. We covered these stories all the way back in episode 21 from June of 2015, so you can go and check that out for more. And that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
...229 different characters spanning the galaxies of the Legion of Superheroes, presented across 7 comic book issues. A new miniseries as part of the Who's Who podcast. To handle this many characters, the Irredeemable Shag is bringing in a ringer, or maybe we should call them Flight Ringers.
Who's Who in the Legion of
Who's
Superheroes.
Who in the Legion of
Who's Who in the Legion of Who's Superheroes.
Who in the Legion of Superheroes.
Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes.
The Legion of Superbloggers team up to present Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes, a 3-episode miniseries in 2017, part of the Who's Who podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Long live the Legion.
It's time for Doomsplaining, when we talk about something that is Doom Patrol related, usually. And today on the show, we are talking about Doom Patrol Volume 2, Issue 56 and 57. And Doom Patrol 56, it was a DC comic, and it came out with a cover date of June 1992. But according to the much more accurate and anally retentive Mike's Amazing World of Comics, it came out on May the 5th, 1992, and it cost $1.50. $1.50, edited by Tom Payer, and it was called Down in the Well. And it was written by Grant Morrison, penciled by Richard Case, inked by Stan Wok, and lettered by Johnny Workman Jr., and colored by Daniel Vozzo. And it had a Simon Bisley cover.
Didn't adjust.
This is probably my least favorite cover of the entire
Doom
Patrol Volume 2 run. It's, it's got a fairly pudgy-looking woman holding a lamb upside down. She is naked. There's a man floating nearby. Looks like he's riding a motorbike underwater. Someone's holding a phone up out of the water. Yeah, I can see these elements in the comic. I just can't see them arranged in that particular way.
No, not really.
And I don't know who that female figure is, because it doesn't match anyone inside the comic particularly.
Well, it becomes clear who it's meant to represent, but yeah, it doesn't look anything like her. But
no, it doesn't. Not a bit.
But considering that person can change their appearance, you know.
Yeah. But this is one I remember, like, when you were looking through back issues trying to find, you know, interesting issues of Doom Patrol, this one was always there.
Funny anyway. That.
Now, I think we need to do something different tonight and say previously in the Doom Patrol, because this is a particularly, it's a turning point in Grant Morrison's run, isn't it?
Isn't it just? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so previously in Doom Patrol, Dorothy, the ape-faced girl with the ability to bring her imagination into reality, confided in Joshua Clay, the team doctor, that she has lost control of the Candlemaker, a dangerous manifestation of evil. Cliff Steele, the robot man, feels the team is falling apart. Rebus, the former Negative Man, has gone to the moon and laid an egg, while Kay Chalice, a.k.a. Crazy Jane, the woman with over 40 multiple personalities with different metahuman powers for each one, has gone to Metropolis following menacing notes from her abusive father. Joshua goes to talk to the chief and is shot by an unseen assailant. Meanwhile, Crazy Jane ended up in Metropolis Cathedral, where she was once raped and is now attacking a policeman as she relieves her trauma.
Well done. Yes. Thank
you. So, police have cordoned off the cathedral entrance, and an officer with a bullhorn tells Crazy Jane to surrender. Jane turns into a naked chick with a red glowing eyes and flaming hair and charges them with firing energy that explodes a cop car. Then she turns into a giant with the sun for a head, a sultry posing underwear model, and finally her regular Kay Chalice self, and she walks away from the police car wreckage and men strewn everywhere and burning vehicles, and she says, "Had enough? I think so." Yeah. On Danny the street, Cliff and Danny are talking via typewriter and then a phone, and Danny has been sensing a growing evil getting stronger and stronger. It is gone now, but it left at the same moment Dorothy and Joshua did. Meanwhile, on a gloomy Monday evening in London, Willoughby Kipling, who's John Constantine stand-in, because they couldn't use John Constantine, has been summoned by his Templar order to a meeting, and knocking on an unmarked door in an alley, a hand brandishing a knife suddenly thrusts forward and points straight at his face, and he is asked for a password. And he says, "Why don't you shove it up your ass?" And correct, he is invited in. Wow. In an underworld hellscape, Willoughby meets with his fellow Templars. One man removes his dentures and they float in the air and fill him in. It's the end of the world. The Doom Patrol has just become the focus for the first major assault in the final war, and you've been chosen to help them. In other words, bugger you, Kipling. Bastards, he says.
Oh, he's so cranky.
He is. Cliff, meanwhile, is visiting the sanitarium where he and Kay Chalice first met as patients back in issue 19 of the Doom Patrol, the start of Grant Morrison's run. Mm. And Cliff tells the doctor that he is worried that Kay has gone to Metropolis to kill her father. The doctor rather doubts that. Kay's father has been dead for nearly 10 years. Cliff says, "Yeah, then who wrote this? Baby lamb, I know where you are and I'm coming to get you. Signed, Daddy." The doctor says, "I should have thought the author of this note was obvious. This is Kay's own handwriting."
What? "Shit,"
says Cliff. The doctor tells Cliff of Kay's rape in Metropolis Cathedral. Perhaps she should try there. Kay, also known as Crazy Jane, has left the city and found her abandoned family farm. Multiple voices in her head compete to tell her different things, but she ignores them and enters the barn. In her memory, she recalls her father pulling her away from the jigsaw she was finishing, scattering the pieces and shattering her life. She recalls her mother always with her lips sewn shut. That's how she pictures her. And she says, "Why didn't you say something, you useless bitch?" After being abused, her father takes Kay's toy, a lamb, baby lamb, Harry, and he says, "I'll show you what happens if you open your big mouth." And the toy is thrown down the well. In anguish, Kay makes her way to the well. One voice inside says, "Cliff, I need Cliff." But another says, "No, this time we do it without him." Passing down through the well, it changes from blackness to a cylinder filled with hot doorways and then back to black. She lands in shallow water and finds her toy lamb, Harry. "Oh, Harry, look at you. I'm sorry, Harry. I'm so sorry. You're all right now. Everything's all right. You're all right now." Cliff has arrived at the cathedral and sees all the damage and the police cars all piled up and wrecked, and there were 6 squad cars destroyed, and the police says she has to take care of this before they do. And Cliff and Denny head back to talk to the chief at Rhode Island headquarters. Perhaps he will have ideas. Down in the well, Jane becomes aware of doors in the walls of the well. She chooses one and finds herself in a hospital room where her father is dying of cancer. Her father is a poor, sick thing. She says to the doctor, "I thought he was a monster." The doctor says, "He is. He should have died a long time ago. It's just the hate machine that keeps him alive. But it uses up so much energy. Perhaps it would be better if all that energy were put to better use." As his daughter, Kay can decide. She decides to switch off the hate machine. The monitor goes into a flat line. Kay is back facing the doors. Hell's at the bottom of the well, they say, but I have to see it. She opens a different door, and suddenly she is standing in sunlight by a mirror lake near a castle. Everything is clean, fresh, and magical. In the Rhode Island DP headquarters, Cliff finds a lone candle in the hallway, recently extinguished. He starts to run. "Josh! Oh, Jesus!" He finds Josh's body with the bullet wound. "Who was it, Josh? Speak to me!" He becomes aware of Chief's wheelchair on its side nearby. "Chief! Oh, Christ!" Niles Calder is standing in the doorway, casually holding a pistol. He says to Cliff, "Don't worry, Cliff. Don't worry about me. I'm right here."
Strange issue, but still kind of good.
We sort of go through all this. I don't know. There's a lot of metaphorical mental stuff going on in Doom Patrol. And then you get to this issue, which is all just plot progress. Yeah, like, the revelation that Jane has been writing the notes to herself. So one of her personalities is destructive and imitating her dad.
Yeah.
And then, she does all this damage in Metropolis, but that's our way into seeing the trauma she faced there, the fact that she was raped by a vagrant in the cathedral. Mm-hmm. And then she, moves on from there to the family farm. So she's sort of going backwards through her history of trauma. And we find out, throughout the series, we've seen her dad call it baby lamb in flashback. And, there is a literal baby lamb toy, Harry.
Mm.
When she finds that in the bottom of the well, there's this moment of saying, "I'm sorry," and apologizing and saying, "It's all right now, everything's all right." And it's a sort of cathartic moment for her.
Yes.
You know, she's confronting what happened. She's apologizing, like Harry is the stand-in for her, and she's apologizing for the trauma that Harry suffered, saying everything's going to be all right. And Grant Morrison writes this beautiful part about hate and how, her father, he's long dead, like he's been dead for nearly 10 years, but he's still alive inside Kay because of her hate for him.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And the line about putting that energy to better use. I really like that part, actually, yeah.
Yeah, hate takes up so much energy and it makes something that shouldn't be in your thoughts prominent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, then she decides to turn off the hate machine and, she is literally letting go of her hate for her dad and she can finally move on from this point. And we see that, back when she's faced with these doors and, doors are usually, peril or freedom. And, the one she goes through certainly leads to what seems to be freedom for her.
Yeah.
But then, the stuff going on with in the Doom Patrol headquarters. So.
So we get a nice bit of closure in Kay's life, and then we open another door, and oh shit!
Yeah.
So you're right. I don't quite get what the cover of 56 really has to do with what goes on inside the issue, other than the woman holding the lamb.
Yeah, in water. So. Perhaps at the bottom of the well.
Yeah.
But visually, it's very incongruous with the Richard Case art inside.
Yeah.
But this seems to be Simon Bisley's modus operandi. He hears what's in the issue and does his version of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He does do the same version.
Yeah.
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 But this one is a particularly jarring, odd looking one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. Cliff finding Josh, and Josh, has this huge bullet wound in his chest, and Cliff is talking to him as if he's alive, but he doesn't seem to be alive at all.
No.
And then when Cliff notices Chief's wheelchair and it's all knocked askew, he worries about Chief, but he shouldn't worry about Chief, because Chief, the man who has been in a wheelchair for decades.
Forever, yeah.
Yeah. Since the day we meet the Chief, he's in a wheelchair, and now isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So what's going on, Mike? Do we need to read the next issue?
No, that's it.
That's it.
That's our show. Happy ending for everyone. No, I'm about to take us into a pivotal moment in Doom Patrol history. Doom Patrol issue 57 from volume 2. Cover dated July 1992. Went on sale June 2nd, 1992 for $2.50. A whole buck extra because it's a 48-page comic.
If you are reading this series for yourself, you may want to consider putting this podcast aside.
Good point. If you're reading volume 2 and you're not up to issue 57, come back later.
Yeah. I mean, I believe the trade that reprints this again is coming out in March, so.
Mm. But, oh, geez, stuff happens in this one. And
this is the one. This is the issue of the whole run where it all happens.
Yeah. Yeah. This,
anyway.
Buckle up, you can make your own choices. And for this fantastic issue, we have to thank writer Grant Morrison, artist Richard Case, San Wach on inks, Mark McKenna also on inks, Johnny Workman Jr. did the letters, and Daniel Vozzo was the colorist. And it continues straight on from the end of issue 56, with Robot Man standing there in shock, looking at the body of Joshua, the Chief's action chair knocked over, and the Chief himself, Niles Calder, standing before him. Chief, what's going on? Calder replies, "Why, Cliff, I don't know what you mean at all." When asked about the fact that he's walking, Calder admits he's been able to do so for some time, but it was easier to maintain the deception. He stands his wheelchair upright and then kicks it so hard it rolls out of the room. "But what about Josh? We just can't leave him here like this," exclaims Cliff. To which Niles replies, "He's dead, Cliff. He's not going to do anything if we leave him. Now please come with me." And they descend in an elevator, and Cliff starts bombarding Calder with questions. And the Chief just says, "Please try to calm yourself, Cliff. You always want to know everything now. What you have to learn is that if you wait long enough, now will come to you." The elevator doors open, and Calder welcomes Cliff into his laboratory and leads him towards a large, deep swimming pool, which Niles has dubbed the Think Tank. As Cliff takes in all this new strangeness, Niles continues to explain that the think tank uses molecular-sized processors to create the most powerful neural net ever assembled, the future of artificial intelligence made possible by his research into nanotechnology. Calder taps some buttons on a console, and an image of one of these nanites appears on a giant monitor screen. Oh, look! How long since a giant monitor screen?
It is a huge monitor.
There it is, Cliff, the world's first universal assembling machine, allowing me complete control over the structure of matter. I've built several of these self-replicating molecular machines, which are capable of any physical task imaginable. These tiny machines can be sent, for instance, into the human bloodstream, performing molecular-level repairs, making illness, diseases, and even death minor correctable complaints. And look, I leave some raw materials in a box with the assemblers, and voila! A synthesized slab of perfect milk chocolate. Mmm. As long as he's getting his chocolate fixed whilst he's, you know, rambling on madly. Stating the bleeding obvious, Cliff exclaims that if these machines really work, they could use them on Josh to bring him back to life, and Calder cuts him off. "That wouldn't be a good idea, Cliff. Surely it's obvious. I killed Josh. It was me." Elsewhere, Dorothy Spinner, the eight-faced girl, is wandering through the darkness as a voice taunts her to make a wish. She comes across a seated figure wearing a crown of burning candles.
"Make a wish, tainted child that you are. Do it. There must be something you want."
She runs away, screaming that she won't do it, and snapping back to reality, she stumbles across Joshua's body. As she cries, she looks over to see a candle appear on the floor.
"Make a wish,"
the voice taunts her. Back in the lab, Cliff demands to know why Josh was killed, and Calder replies, "It was because he was beginning to suspect what I was doing, and I'd had enough of his questions. Tonight was the final straw. He had no right to intrude, and it was his own fault." Cliff explains that Josh was actually coming to ask for help with Dorothy because there's something wrong with her. To which Calder replies, "Ah, well, it was a rare and unfortunate error on my part. These things happened." Like, what? Enraged, Cliff leaps forward to attack, but Calder turns and zaps him with a device, immobilizing him. "When I rebuilt you, I included an electronic failsafe mechanism, just in case I ever had to stop you." Now then, I suppose you must be rather curious now. And we cut back to the darkness. Dorothy confronts her tormentor. "All right, I did what you wanted. I made a wish. Now do what you said you'd do. Bring Mr. Clay back to life." The demonic figure wearing the crown of candles reappears, as does Josh, who suddenly brought back to life asks, "Where am I?" But just then, the being crushes Josh into nothingness.
"You thought you could stop me, little Dorothy. You thought I belonged to you. But you're just the door I walked through. When I'm ready, I'll kill you too."
Dorothy's left sobbing on the floor beside the smoking ashes of Josh's body. And back in the lab, the paralyzed Cliff endures Calder's monologuing, and as he reveals his ultimate goal has been to create life, and he finally did it, and he reveals a large, white, man-shaped artificial figure he has created. It's not quite complete, but for me, this creature is only the beginning. Calder continues on, retelling of his brilliant youth and how a donation of $2 million from a mysterious benefactor led to his work on extending lifespans, even though that benefactor turned out to be General Immortus. Calder continues to retell his origin and says how Immortus planted a bomb within Niles to force him to hand over his work, and how Immortus shot him in a confrontation which Niles hoped would end his own life, but he lived despite the loss of use of his legs, and how his robotic assistant RA2 saved his life and helped him destroy his lab so Immortus wouldn't gain anything, but then Niles shot the robot dead. Killing RA2 was just like killing a friend. But then again, each new experience enriches us, good or bad. This is like, wow, yeah. At this point, Niles has removed the skull cap from Cliff's head, exposing his brain, and he's lowered a contraption from the ceiling so that several needles are aimed at his grey matter. Calder then brings up a diagram on the giant monitor and tries to explain the theoretical underpinning to all of this. The image on screen depicts what is known as the catastrophe curve, and catastrophe theory provides the topological model on the screen, representing the introduction of sudden, discontinuous change into a stable system. While the effects of a catastrophe can't be predicted, the model can be used to ascertain the conditions most favourable for its manifestation. Niles admits that following his confrontation with Immortus, he began to conceive a grand scheme. With his own life transformed by catastrophes, he became interested in creating similar effects in others. He just needed some test subjects for these experiments, and he did indeed find them. What would happen to the selfish, arrogant, overconfident, yet ill-educated, daredevil race car driver Cliff Steele if a catastrophe was introduced into the life of this man who had everything? What would happen to the successful pilot Larry Trainer, sure of himself and convinced of his own magnificent destiny, if his experimental aircraft was sabotaged? And what would happen to that fabulous gilded creature, the object of envy, Hollywood starlet Rita Farr, if a sudden catastrophe brought her low and unable to control her own life? Niles finally admits, "I contrived means by which to bring us all together, as if by accident, and as you know, we became the Doom Patrol." Through their disfigurement, Niles had the patrol show the world that freaks and cripples had as much to offer as the so-called able-bodied, if not more. But Calder admits that over time, the patrol became the focus of his life, distracting him from his real work, and so he forced them into situations that grew increasingly hazardous, right up until Zal destroyed the team and the island that they were on. Oh, and by the way, Niles reveals that he saved himself from the destruction of that island with his own personal force shield. Nice.
Like he says, "I could have saved Rita."
He could have saved Rita.
But I thought something interesting might happen to her if I did.
Yeah. Saddened by the fact that the explosion of the island didn't create new mutations in any of the team, Calder moved on to India, where he met a young girl named Irani. And she was just one more face in that country's teeming millions who no one seemed to care about. So that, of course, made her an ideal test subject. And so to gain her trust, he admits he went through a ludicrous marriage ceremony for concocting a story necessitating his return to America. But before leaving, he gave her a dose of his longevity serum. This worked for a while, but the serum was flawed and began eating away at Arani's brain. I guess that kind of explains some things. Not that Noz really cared, for he was back in America, having gained work with the government, before his eventual reunion with the current patrol. And having caught up to the present, Niles finally reveals what he's been planning to do. I've spoken of the importance of catastrophe to progress and change. Think of the minor incidents that made you and the others what you are today, Cliff. Now imagine a mass incident generating a global catastrophe curve. What might happen then? How would humanity be forced to adapt and change? With my nanomachines, I can do it. I can remake the world and everyone in it. But would I survive all of that? Well, it occurred to me that I might be able to download my consciousness into a superhuman physical vehicle, such as the new being I've created. And with the help of the think tank, I've found a way. Of course, I need to test this theory, which is where you come in, Cliff. Perhaps I should stop talking now, but it's hard to stop. I've kept this all to myself for far too long. I'm unsure about what kind of world will exist when I'm finished, but I know it will be better for everyone. I believe in the catastrophe. I welcome it with open arms. Just as Niles finally begins to put his plan into action, the white humanoid being he created lunges forward and attacks Niles. It grips tightly around Caller's head and then rips his head right off his body, throwing it against a wall. God. The features of the being start to change as well. It's no longer a blank canvas devoid of features. The eyes turn sinister, and a crown of candles begins to protrude from its head. The being turns to Cliff.
You're another of them, aren't you? The Doom Patrol. You might be a danger to me while I'm still in this intermediate stage of physical manifestation. But you can't move, can you? Not a single inch, no matter what I do.
And the now monstrous figure grabs Cliff's brain from out of his head, crushes it, and throws it to the floor. Tattered, demonic-looking wings spread open from the monster's back as it bellows.
It's been such a long time. I've had so much time to think about what I'm going to do to the world. I'm King Candle. I'm the Candle Maker. The Candle Maker.
Oh my god, and that's where the issue ends.
Whoa.
Yeah, so... not a happy ending in that one.
Yeah, so basically every single thing that looked dodgy about what Niles did and everything that's slightly arrogant, etc., is just revealed to be deliberate and planned. And, yep, he was you know, the man who wanted to serve extra heads onto dogs.
Yep.
It was all just experimenting with life. And this issue, it was like a punch to the gut when I first read it.
It was then and it was now. I haven't read this issue in years. And the way that it goes back through everything we've seen from Niles, even from volume one in the 60s, well, yeah, it showed him putting, you know, an extra head on animals. And it showed his first meeting with Immortus and, you know, the mysterious $2 million. And it showed him meeting Arani and it showed what happened with the team when they met Zal. And it's like, oh my God.
Yeah, and so he was married to Arani. She was telling the truth all along.
Yes.
Yeah, and he implies that she was having some sort of mental degenerative disease, so which maybe led to her suicide, which, yeah, it's crazy stuff.
And the fact that his plan is that he's going to improve the world through catastrophe, and he doesn't really care what is going to happen to people because he'll be fine. Well, he thought he would be fine, you know, in his own, with his consciousness downloaded into a new body. But man, it's like, that's what and the fact that he's the one that triggered the accidents that created the Doom Patrol in the first place.
Yeah. No, that like, is, I mean, that is a really ballsy retcon.
Yes. And the fact that, you know, he was sitting there in the stands at the race arena, you know, eating chocolate as as Cliff's car exploded, you know, it's like, oh my God, it's like He's pure. I'm reluctant to say evil, but it's evil. He's a madman.
Well, it's. I mean, am I correct in saying it's sociopathic? There's just a total disregard for, you know, anyone's feelings except your own.
That sounds correct. Yes.
There's no empathy. It's, you know, everything to him is something he can look at. You know, any other person's suffering is just interesting to him.
Yeah.
You know, and he treats people like they are not, you know, on the same plane as him.
No,
like
they're just test subjects to him.
Treats people like ants.
Yeah.
So, wow. And this whole, you know, and the topping this revelation by, you know, we've had this great big long monologue of him telling everything and telling about all his secret plans and everything. And, you know, you realize the Doom Patrol are completely unaware of this. They've been manipulated by this man for decades, you know, what, 30 years in comic book time and who know, you know, at least, you know, 20 years in DC Universe time. But, you know, they are completely unaware. And then Grant Morrison tops it by having the Candlemaker suddenly intervene and, you know, destroy Miles Calder's body, rips his head clean off, and then destroys Cliff's brain.
It's like, well, Miles wanted catastrophe and, you know, you can't really predict it. Oh, and oh, look, here's a catastrophe right on your doorstep, Miles.
Yeah, and the title of this issue is The Nature of the Catastrophe. Do you want to talk about the cover at all?
Well, it's another piece by Bisley, and it's basically just a very evil-looking Niles Calder.
With
a giant mustache twirled. and he's, the way he appears is kind of odd. It's almost like he's lying on the ground with his face towards the reader and his, you know, these kind of mangled, twisted legs trailing behind him. So
yeah.
Which we learn was, you know, never really the case at all. You know, at some stage he healed himself and it's just another part of the deception. But my God, the Niles on the cover of this just looks so evil.
Yeah. It's, this is, I mean, this is probably, I don't know, one of the best single issues that Grant Morrison's ever written, I'd say.
Yeah.
Like it just turns everything on its head. You can see the long game he's been playing and the way he's, you know, taken existing characters and sort of, you know, thought about what explains all this motivation. I mean, even down to the fact that Niles had this robot assistant that he killed. It's just like, well, that was odd when we read it in the 60s comics. And here he repaints as just like, you know, it was really just an experiment with Niles' emotions, you know. It doesn't mean anything to kill, you know, someone who saved his life.
Yeah.
No. Not really.
And
he says it's distasteful, I think.
Oh, good grief. Distasteful. But I, as shocking as the turn in this is, I do love the way that he went right back through Patrol history and tied it all together. At the same time as flipping it completely around, into the fact that Niles is just, you're right, a sociopathic madman who has had this one goal all along, and it's the very formation of the Patrol has been leading up to this point.
Yeah.
Well, until the Candlemaker stepped in, but you know. Yeah, I was reading this again and I literally slapped my forehead at one point. It was just like, it's such brilliant writing. In a way, for those that have been reading The Patrol through, well, you know, from volume one up to this point, it's like a massive payoff, but like a really bad payoff as well.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. It's just,
This is such a page turner, this whole comic. Like, I read 56 and then I went straight into 57 afterwards, and it was just, I was reading it as fast as I could. It was, you know, just gripping. And, you know, this is me knowing the story and knowing, read it several times before.
Exactly,
It's so powerfully written.
You both you and I, Paul, and those that have, you know, read this issue before, we know that it's happened. We know that it occurs. in the Patrol's history, but to still read it again, it's still, like you said, it's still a gut punch.
Yeah.
It's so powerful. Oh, it's just, and then from this point on, things get even worse, you know? Because you've got decapitated Niles, Cliff's brain's been removed from his body, and the Candlemaker's on the loose. So, you know, and the only people really left on the team, well, are Dorothy. And Jane.
Rebus is somewhere.
So, yeah, it's not looking good. It's not looking good at all.
Yeah, and remember Rebus said to the chief in an early issue, "I know what you're up to." And
that's right.
The chief said, "Well, we'll have to see how this plays out." So, but the fact that he didn't even kill Joshua for any reason, he just was sick of being bothered.
Yeah, yeah. That's how cold is that?
Yeah, I mean, he basically thought that Josh was snooping.
Yeah.
Whereas Josh was actually coming to help, you know, for help that with something the chief might have been able to help with.
No, it didn't turn out that way, did it? No.
Well, that decision bit the chief, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's such a great issue. Such a massive moment in the Patrol's history.
It's crazy.
I
think we've decided that we'll accelerate the way we cover the rest of the Grant Morrison run.
I think we'll have to, because
from this point.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's only fair, considering that some later volumes do make reference to what's happened, well, in this issue and the fallout from it. So I think, yeah, it'd be probably better to, as you say, accelerate through the Morrison stuff.
Yeah. So after this, there's a special and then six issues, and that's it for Morrison. And then we move into Rachel Pollack.
Cool.
So that's still in the Vertigo run. Well, it's technically it's not even Vertigo yet. Vertigo didn't exist when this issue came out.
This is true.
Yeah, Vertigo debuted with the Rachel Pollack issue.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, this is Vertigo.
This is so Vertigo.
It is. Vertigo as.
Oh, so how are you feeling, mate? You okay? You think we've doomsplained that one enough?
I think we have.
Yeah, I'm going to go need to lie down.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Trekker Talk. A fan podcast devoted to the adventures of 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the pages of Trekker Comics by creator, writer, and artist Ron Randall. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. We'll be discussing the stories, characters, and art in this excellent retro sci-fi adventure series, as well as having side conversations about other areas of fandom.
We hope you'll join us as we travel from the dangerous back streets of New Gallif to the depths of outer space and everywhere in between.
Trekker Talk is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Find us at trekkertalk.com.
Okay, so it's time for the Mailbag of Doom, and this week we asked you, what is the best cliffhanger ending to something? And first off, on the Twitters, we heard from Jay Bandoy, at W Bandoy, and he said, so an airplane splits in half mid-flight, and they crash land on no ordinary island. To survive, they work together to face others, whilst facing kidnappings, a smoke monster, and then stumble upon a hatch. After making a decision to open it, Lost Season 1 ends with a shot of a dark path that shows very little and a broken ladder. What's in the hatch is what I kept asking myself till season two. That was a good one. Yeah.
Rogue Frack, who's at Fractures on Twitter, our mate Frack, he says Inception was his one. And then Cameron Williams, who's at Wasgo, says Inception wasn't a cliffhanger. And Fractures says, I thought it was. That's how people should debate.
That's right. Civil and polite. And
yeah.
We heard from Ange at Dr. Ange 70 on Twitter. And he said, end of crisis in Infinite Earths 4. First time I saw the slow fade of everything until only White Page left. Monitor died, thought he was going to be part of the whole series. Seriously didn't know of Earth survived. Great cliffhanger until 5.
Mm, yeah, that's good. I think I own that White Page. I think I've got it somewhere. Fractures chimed in again with the Twin Peaks finale.
Nah, that was a good one.
Yeah.
With him kind of bashing his head in the mirror and laughing. Yeah, as you do.
As you do.
Oh, look, it's Aaron Long at Juice005. His favourite cliffhanger to something was that issue of Doom Patrol that Mike and Hixie talked about that time for like half an hour. You know the one I mean. It had Wolverine.
I do know the one he means.
You do? That's one of us.
I think it's the Doom Force special.
Right. Okay.
Fractures is back. Yeah. Daredevil 232, God and Country. I'm sure I've read that. Sounds like a Frank Miller one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Could be the Russian roulette one with Bullseye.
Oh, okay. Right. Abel Padzilla at Abel Padzilla on Twitter said, the end of Flash Season 1, Reverse Flash gone, Jay Garrick helmet, giant wormhole over Central City. How the heck will Barry fix this alone? That was a good cliffhanger.
Ending. It was, wasn't it? Yeah, he's going to run. We heard from Cash Flag, who's aka Al, and who's at Reba02 on the Twitter, and he said, comics, forget which issue, but in Reign of the Superman, when the cyborg Superman is revealed to be evil. Yeah, ooh, that's awesome. And the Coast City blows up, and you go, ah! That's a really good, because we didn't know, like, there were all these fake Supermen, and we didn't know which one was, yeah. Anyway, so that was that. And he said, TV Buffy Season 5. I wasn't even sure the show was coming back. And he said, movies Empire Strikes Back.
Lodix at Lodix1, and I think this is the first response I've had from Lodix, said, best cliffhanger to anything has to be the ending of Back to the Future 2, or in comics, when Adrian says, I did it 30 minutes ago.
Watchmen. Nice. We heard from Emma Hoosboss.
I think it might be Hooksboy.
Hooksboy?
Emma, apologies if we're mispronouncing your
surname. We are butchering your name.
Yes.
We're not very careful with anything on this show particularly, so don't feel like we're singling you out.
No.
She said, to anything, Kill Bill Volume 1, the reveal of Beatrix's daughter being alive. That was good.
Yeah. We heard from Cal at Introspection, and Cal said Inception as well.
Another new voice on the show.
Yes. Thanks for chiming in, guys.
Yeah, over on the Facebook, we heard Stephen Usery say, well, literally the end of the original Italian Job. Do you remember that?
I haven't seen the original one, no.
Oh, I think like a truck ends up dangling over a cliff with the money at one end and all the
books at the other end. Oh, dear.
If I remember correctly.
Jared Driscoll also chimed in on the Facebook page and said, the Titans Hunt story arc from the early 90s in the New Titans series. Looking back now, the story was lame, but as a teenager, the shock ending of those early issues of that story arc had me on tender hooks each month.
Yeah, no, I really loved Titans Hunt when it came on. Mm-hmm. Went a little way into it, I sort of realized that the writers didn't know what they were doing. Like they were making it up as they went.
Right.
Like, there's a character just... It's contradictory who's behind it. Like, there's something that really doesn't make sense when you look at it as far as all the way through.
Okay.
But, you know, it happens. Comics.
It does.
Not everyone is very careful.
No. And still on the Facebook, we had a massive post from Ryan Daly, the man of a million podcasts. And he said, okay, this is my response to the question of the week. Best cliffhanger. I had to post it here rather than Twitter because it's a bit lengthy. That's what she said. The best cliffhanger ending was the second season finale of the TV drama Nip Tuck. If you never saw it, and I'm assuming most people didn't, it's about two plastic surgeons living in Miami, Florida. So it's part medical drama, but also dabbles in the excesses of beauty, vanity, celebrity, all the horrible things that happen in Florida on a regular basis. Anyway, in the second season, they introduce this running subplot of a masked serial rapist known as the Carver, who stalks models and disfigures their faces. One of the main characters of the show, Dr. Sean McNamara, reconstructs their faces. This gets the Carver's attention, who feels like Sean is ruining his work. In the penultimate episode, the Carver breaks into Sean's house and injects him with a paralytic drug. Sean is awake but immobile whilst the Carver taunts him and does his villain monologue shtick. Oh, another one of those. Finally, the Carver cuts Sean from his mouth to his ear and leaves with the warning, "Operate on another one of my victims and the next day I will kill you." So, of course, his friends and family freak out and tell Sean not to operate on another one of the Carver's victims. And as expected, another patient comes in all carved up. Sean's partner, Dr. Christian Troy, pleads with him to pass the patient on to someone else, but Sean refuses to give in to the Carver. He fixes the victim's face and then gets a gun to wait for the Carver to come after him. Now, this was one of many plots running through the second season, but it comes to a head in the season finale. Sean has decided to leave himself vulnerable as bait for the Carver, hoping his attacker returns so Sean can kill him. However, in the final 2 minutes of the episode, which plays out beautifully to Art Garfunkel's All I Know, we see the Carver strike. Except the Carver broke into Christian's apartment and paralyzes him with the drug. The episode ends with Sean laying in his bed, wide awake with a gun, waiting for the attack that isn't coming, because the Carver is standing over Sean's best friend. Then the Silent Stalker slashes down towards Christian and the screen goes to credits. It was an amazing, gut-punching season finale and the best cliffhanger I've ever seen.
Ooh. Wow.
Jeez.
That does sound big.
Tense.
Yeah. I think Ryan's the first person I ever knew of who watched Nip Tuck.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, anyway, moving on from the question of the week. So, well, Mike, what's your response?
There were so many good ones. And I had a decent answer before, but I've forgotten it. So I'm going to say, as a youngster, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
The revelation from Darth Vader, the loss of Luke's hand, the loss of Han himself, you know, this other new character driving off in the Millennium Falcon, what the hell? So, yeah, it was kind of like, what's going to happen next? So, but the weird thing is, I saw that original trilogy out of order as a kid. So I didn't see... Empire until after I'd well and truly seen Jedi. So
wow.
By the time I saw Empire, I was like,
right.
Okay. But it was still a good cliffhanger anyway. Yeah. What about you, Paul?
I'm going to go TV. Blake 7. Are you familiar with Blake 7?
I am familiar with it. I don't remember a lot about it because I was rather young when I did see that.
Okay, so this was created by Terry Nation, the man who created the Daleks for Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sci-fi, so I just had to watch it.
Yes.
But it's about a bunch of freedom fighters, or terrorists, as we'd call them today, who are fighting against an evil organization called the Federation. So I like to imagine it's the Star Trek universe, the dirty underbelly of that.
Yeah. Yes.
But anyway, so... There's this band of seven led by a guy called Blake. And at the end of the first season of the show, Blake basically gets killed in a mission.
Mm-hmm.
And then this sort of bastard who works with Blake called Avon takes over running the team.
Yep.
And he's always torn between, you know, committing crimes and, you know, furthering their freedom fighting agenda. But at the very last episode of the last season, Blake is back from the dead and Avon is confronted by him and they have a standoff and there's this moment, is it really Blake? Can Avon trust him? And Avon raises his gun and the screen goes black and you just hear different sounds of different guns firing.
Wow.
And that's how the show ends.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Mm.
Yeah.
Gosh.
But yeah, great characterization in that show. Some, you know, crappy effects, great characterization. Very BBC for the day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. So that was my choice. But we got an email from Dr. Ange.
Oh,
he
yes?
said he wanted to talk about the show we did last time, about the Volume 3 of the Doom Patrol. Anyway, but he said, thanks for the new year episode and the continued coverage of this volume of the Doom Patrol. As you hint, this is a complete blind spot for me. I think it was still reeling a bit from the awesomeness of Morrison and, for me, the dip in quality with Pollock. So I think I avoided it because I thought, why bother? It ain't Morrison. And I can see now that I should have read it. I understand Paul's comment on comic delays, but I can tell you that I find it maddening maddening, he says. These are people doing a job to get comics out on a monthly basis. That is their line of work with deadlines. So I think just think that they should try to honour that. Imagine if you missed deadlines at your job or showed up late over and over. I don't think people would necessarily gloss over it. I also wonder how much lead time did the creative team have? We are delayed 3 issues in. You would think that DC would wait for 6 issues to be done, ready for publishing before releasing the first issue. This way there is some lead time. But to be honest, knowing how busy Jared Way is and how detailed Nick Darrington is, DC should have done them a favour and made the book bi-monthly to begin with. And I will echo Mike's love for the end battle in Batman vs. Superman. I found the whole movie an inscrutable, depressing mess, but it is on HBO in the States these days, and I will stop and watch that end battle scene when I can. That scene with Wonder Woman wrapping up Doomsday in the magic lasso and Batman jumping around is the stuff Kid Ange dreamed of.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Lastly, I couldn't help but think of a great Abbott and Costello comedy scene could be written using the characters from this current issue. Imagine if people mishear Now Yut as Not Yet and Yan Bo as Yu Bao. So scene, Robot Man explaining courtly etiquette to Now Yut and Yan Bo. So he's made Yan Bo a person, whereas it's an object in the comic. Anyway, but we'll roll with it. Okay, guys, when the princess comes in, you wait until she is standing before us and then you bow, but she has to come to a stop before you do it or you breach etiquette. And the princess walks into the hall, still far away. Yan Bao starts to bow prematurely. Not yet. And Now Yat says, yes. Cliff says, what? Now Yat says, you called my name? No, I didn't. I was telling him not to start bowing. Who? Yan Bao. Oh, okay. And they begin bowing. No, not yet. I'll tell you when to bow. Yan Bao says, yes. What? You called my name? No, I was telling him that I would tell him when you bow. You bow. Okay, begins bowing. No, not yet. No, Yat says, yes, you called my name again. Cliff exasperated. Anyway, and Ange says, well, I think that's funny. And thanks again for a great show. I will have you know that my New Year's resolution is to not talk about Men at Work with you anymore.
And, oh, my God.
Oh.
Wow.
That's a big call.
That's a very big call. Gotta buy some new phone, music.
Making the big buttons. Anyway, ooh, that was very amusing. Well done, Ange.
Well done. Well done.
It does lend itself to that.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying that, Ange. So, Mike, what's next for us?
Next week on the show, it's brand new Doom Patrol.
What?
Yes. Issue 4 of Volume 6. Hallelujah.
Oh.
I know.
Yeah. That's
and
amazing.
And we've got a question of the week too, apparently.
Right.
And that is, which powers and disadvantages and or disadvantages of a Doom Patrol member would you most want to have?
I think I'm saying that because, you know, you can have the powers of the Doom Patrol, but you really, you get something negative pretty much with every character.
So, okay, so it is both. Which powers and disadvantages of a Patrol member would you most want to have?
They're a mixed blessing.
And we can mix it up. We can have like a power from one and a disadvantage from another.
Well, you're breaking
No, it's got to be... Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Sure.
Hmm.
Wow. Okay. I'm thinking caps on for that one.
Yes. And next week on the show, we've already said that, so I can...
Sorry, I think we're both in a bit of a state of shock from issue 57.
It'll be a stunt.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a gut punch. Oh.
Mm. Yeah, well, thank you for joining us, everyone. Thank you for joining us, Mike.
Thank you for joining us.
You want to respond to the question of the week, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at WFDpod. You can send an email to waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can get on the Facebook, leave a post there, or you can catch up with Doug's post about the show and leave your response at the end of his post. Yeah. So, what are we going to now? I might have a lie down.
Have a lie down. Have a rest and recover from issue 57.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. All right, guys. We'll sign off. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, Paul. And, we'll catch you all again next week for more Waiting for Doom.
Good for Doom. Hello.
Make a wish.
How are you?
Is this the right number?